Okay, if you haven't opened your Bibles yet to Genesis 3, please turn there. We're studying marriage, and we come to the question this morning, why there are so many problems with marriage. What's the problem with marriage? You pick your absolute favorite person in the world to marry, right? Out of all the people, you pick the one you like the best, and you marry that person, and you can't get along with your favorite person in the entire planet. Why is that? You get along just fine with other people, people that you don't love nearly as much as you love your spouse. I've never known a single married person, including myself, that hasn't had marital problems. Everybody has marital problems who's married. Tracy is absolutely one of the most delightful human beings God ever put on this planet. So why do I have trouble at times getting along with her? And why are there so many divorces? I mean, what's going on with that? I'd be willing to bet there are far more marriages break up than regular friendships. Don't you see? I doubt there's a 50% breakup rate among regular friendships. And it's really a lot easier to break up a regular friendship and a lot cheaper. Right? Than to get a divorce. And when there is a breakup in a marriage, a divorce, why is it so incredibly painful? When you have two roommates that used to be great friends and now they're not getting along so great and so one of them moves out, it's not as life-shattering and agonizing and the bitter upheaval that happens in a divorce. Why? What is the problem with marriage? Why is it so hard and so fraught with problems? Well, the answer, as Ken Ham would say, is in Genesis. Genesis chapter 3, to be exact, marriage is affected by both the fall and the curse. In marriage, in Genesis chapter 2, God created marriage, and He created His ideal for marriage. He showed us that ideal, and we've studied that the last few weeks. We've seen the ideal. Adam was a very, very happily married man, and Eve was a happily married woman. And when they sinned, there were some drastic effects, not only on their marriage, but on the human race in general across the board, on mankind, and on marriage as an institution. If we're going to fix the problems that come in marriage, we need to do the same thing that we would do if we were fixing anything else. Think of how we fix things. Think of how an auto mechanic fixes a car. He starts out with a thorough knowledge of how the engine is supposed to function, and then he looks to find out what went wrong with that. And then he fixes it by restoring that part back to the way it was originally designed to be. Right? That's basic. That's fixing 101. Right? I'm no car expert, but I know that's what they do. They find out what's wrong, and they restore it back the way it's supposed to be. There are an army of marriage counselors out there who are like auto mechanics who figure out what's wrong, but then instead of trying to restore it back to the manufacturer's original specs, they come up with their own creative ideas from their own personal experience. The solution to marital problems is not to say that men are from Mars and women are from Venus and we figure the differences out between the sexes and then we come up with creative ideas on how to get along understanding the other person's differences. Nor is it what you read in most marriage, even Christian marriage books, which tell you to give your spouse what they need so that you can get your spouse to give you what you need. That's just manipulation. The solution is to follow what the manual says about the factory specs of marriage. To restore your marriage back to Genesis 2. And the only way you're going to be able to do that is if you understand what happened in Genesis 3. How it got fouled up. Genesis 3 tells us what happened to marriage. And so the only way we're going to be able to get back to Genesis 2 is if we understand what happened in Genesis 3. I hope you understand what an important chapter Genesis 3 is. You realize if we take Genesis 3 out of the Bible, or if we interpret it in some figurative way so that there's really no actual serpent, there never really was any real serpent, or there never really was any literal actual Adam and Eve, you realize what that does? What that does is it makes God the author of evil. Genesis 3 is the chapter in the Bible that tells us where evil and suffering and decay and disease and death all came from. And if you ask yourself, where did all that come from? What is the source of all that? It did not come from God. When God created everything, it was good. Nothing was wrong with it. There was no evil, there was no suffering, there was no death. But then, in Genesis 3, man sinned, and with sin came evil and death and suffering and disease and all that. And so that was all the result of man's sin. If we come up with a way to interpret the creation account, Genesis 1, 2, and 3, in some way to make it, force-fit it to line up with the world's theories about origins in the beginning. And we say that dinosaurs lived millions of years before there were ever human beings. I want you to think through the implications of that. The fossil record is a record of death, right? Is that right? Isn't that true that every fossil they've ever found is dead? Okay. And not only that, but in the fossils, not only are they dead, but we find evidence of disease and suffering. There are dinosaur bones that give clear evidence of dinosaurs that had brain tumors and cancer and injuries and all kinds of things. So you have animals suffering and dying with pain and diseases and suffering and sickness long before any human being ever sinned in that system, which means God just created it that way. Have you ever seen an animal really suffer? I mean, just really suffer. It's just an absolutely horrible thing to watch. Those who want to cram the Bible, Genesis 1 to 3, to match secular history, theories of history, would have us believe that God created the world a world of pain and sorrow and suffering and disease and cancer and decay and death and looked at it all and said, it is very good. Genesis 3 is essential for us to be able to make sense out of evil. We need that chapter. You remove that one chapter from, and the whole Bible no longer makes sense. The whole Bible collapses. God makes everything in Genesis 1. In chapter 2, we have paradise, ideal harmony with God, with one another, full access to the tree of life. Then in chapter 4, what do you have? Murder. Man kills his own brother. He brags to his numerous wives about what a great murderer he is. He's estranged from God. By the end of the chapter 3, there's polygamy and mass murder. Chapter 5, we see the phrase, he died, repeated 8 times over and over. He died, he died. The whole human race is dominated by death. Everybody dies. And then by the time we get to chapter 6, we read, the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. And Yahweh was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was so filled with pain. So Yahweh said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth. If you don't have Genesis 3 in between chapter 2 and all that mess, it doesn't make sense. There's no explanation for how it went from perfect paradise to evil so horrible that God has to wipe it out. Man chose sin and death, and a lot of things that were included in that package of sin and death that came in chapter 3. It came with a curse, and it brought susceptibility to sin, estrangement from God, sickness, pain, sorrow, suffering, decay, death, domination of evil across the board. None of that was a part of the creation originally. It came from man's rebellion. God's response to man's sin could have been just wipe out mankind, start all over again, or just be done with it altogether. But instead, he sets this plan of redemption in place that would reverse man's plunge into evil at the cost of his own son. So let's take a look specifically at the effect of what happened in Genesis 3 on marriage, because that's the main thrust in Genesis. The account of the ideal in chapter 2 for marriage ended with the words, the man and his wife were both naked and felt no shame. That's the summary. That's the end. That's how it stops. This whole section on the ideal, God's ideal for marriage. Man and wife, both naked, felt no shame. Naked and unashamed. Now watch the very first thing that happens when they sin. Chapter 3, verse 6. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some of it and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. And the eyes of both of them were opened. And watch the very first thing that happens. They realized they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. So much for naked and unashamed. Remember when last week we looked at the 5 components of God's ideal for marriage? And one of those 5, the last one, was naked and unashamed. Now that's the first thing to go. Now they're ashamed, and they have to cover themselves up. We found last week that naked and unashamed is a description of intimacy. They were completely comfortable with each other, totally safe, with each other. There's no fear of the spouse having any negative judgment at all about you, which enabled you to have complete openness with the spouse. And so that was that's what naked and unashamed pointed to. And the physical nakedness, I believe, is just the picture, symbolic of the whole relationship. The whole relationship was a naked and unashamed relationship. They had no fear that the other one would criticize or look down or make them feel foolish or be disrespectful or be unkind in any way. There was absolute, total vulnerability because there was zero threat of being hurt in any way. No threat. No danger. And so there's total openness. Nothing to protect. But after they sinned, they wanted to cover themselves up and put up barriers because now there was some threat and they had to watch out and guard themselves from being hurt. So they had to take up a defensive posture. And a defensive posture destroys intimacy in a relationship. You can't be in a loving posture and a defensive posture simultaneously. You can't. The more you're focused on guarding yourself, the less you're focused on loving your spouse. And so when they started guarding themselves, they backed off away from loving each other. Because love is focused on the other person. Guarding is focused on yourself, trying to protect yourself. Danger is always the killer of intimacy because it destroys trust. Where there's danger, where there's a spouse that is in danger, where there's a risk of being hurt by the other one, there can't be intimacy because you have to have your guard up. If expressing my feelings to you is dangerous, it might result in me being mocked or ridiculed or gossiped about, then I'm going to be slow to share my feelings with you, right? I mean, that's just natural. If I'm telling you my opinions and my opinions might result in me getting shot down, or if getting into a conversation about my deep desires in my heart is going to put me at risk of being looked down upon by you, naturally I'm going to be reluctant to do that. So danger shuts down intimacy. What happens instead is you just get a facade, which means you're not interacting with the real me. I put up a facade. Now I'm safe behind my facade. It's not the real me. But there's no intimacy because you're interacting with the wall. The more dangerous it is, and the less I can trust you, the more our relationship will have to stay at the surface level. Okay? So if the intimacy and oneness between Adam and Eve was broken, it's not surprising at all that what we read in the following verses, verse 8. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of Yahweh God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And they hid from Yahweh God among the trees of the garden. But Yahweh God called out to the man, "Where are you?" And he answered, "I heard you in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." So you see what happens here is their sin destroyed intimacy with God. For the very first time in their existence, they're now hiding from God and attempting to avoid God's presence. They're ashamed before Him, and instead of seeking forgiveness or restoration, they just want to run away, just avoid Him. So it comes as no surprise whatsoever that their marriage is messed up, right? The only way to have a Genesis 2 marriage, ideal, God's ideal for marriage, the only way to have that is by grace. And so if you're not close to God, if you are distancing yourself from God, you are forfeiting that grace, and you're not going to be able to be close to your spouse. Because you can't have that without grace. We learn this again and again in when we were studying 1 John. Remember, you cannot love people without loving God. 99% of solving the problems in our marriages is simply walking more closely with the Lord. When I do marriage counseling, basically all I do, they come in there and we figure out, what are your sins? Okay, we'll work on sanctification there. What are your sins? We'll work on sanctification there. You both get closer to the Lord. And as you both get closer to the Lord, Lord is here, she's here, he's here. They both get closer to the Lord, they get closer to each other. That's just the way, it's just like a triangle. Going to the top of a triangle. And so you can't, solving marital problems is mainly just sanctification in certain areas. The more intimacy you have with God, the more anger and unforgiveness and selfishness is going to be pushed out of your heart, and you'll be full of kindness and gentleness and patience and joy and love. And when you have that, you've got a good marriage. And when your irritability and selfishness is replaced by kindness and joy and love, the problems of your marriage will all be improved. So, once Adam and Eve start avoiding God, immediately their marriage becomes sour, because where there's no true love for people, there's no true love for God, and where there's no closeness to God, there's no real love for people. And so we aren't surprised the very first words out of Adam's mouth after he sins, very first thing that he says after the sin, after the fall, are selfish, unloving words. God comes and demands an accounting from Adam, and immediately he just throws his wife under the bus just to save face. He doesn't care one bit about her. He said, "Who told you that you are naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" That's what God says to Adam. And the man said, "The woman that you put here with me, she gave me some fruit, and I ate it." The popular term for that is blame shifting, right? This is a natural response of the unrepentant heart when sin is pointed out. You know, Adam's like, "It's not my fault. You know, all I did was went to sleep one day and woke up married. It wasn't even my doing. And it's this woman that you gave me. And she got me into this." This is the natural reaction of our hearts when we sin. We want to push the blame somewhere else. Why did you do that? Well, you got to understand. She did this. You didn't help. And you did that. And someone else did this. And if you wouldn't understand the circumstances, everybody's sinning against me. And nobody's helping me. And on it goes. The flesh, our flesh is like a wild animal. Cornered, it's dangerous. You get it cornered, and it comes after you in an attack. And so Adam doesn't hesitate a second to just point to Eve's blame. You don't do that to someone you love. You cover over their faults and sins, if at all possible. You're late because your wife wasn't ready in time. You don't arrive and say, "We're late because of her." You arrive and just say, "Sorry, we're late. We had trouble getting ready." You cover over everything you can cover over if you love the person. Love takes such delight in the other person, so strongly desires to protect that person, that it'll gladly take scorn upon itself in order to protect the other. But selfishness just throws the person under the bus in a heartbeat just to save face. And it'll stop at nothing, even to the point of blaming God, which is essentially what Adam was doing, right? "This woman that you gave me." He's really pointing the finger at God. So in verse 13, God demands an accounting now from the woman. He started with the man, and then he points to the woman. Now he goes to the woman and says, "What is this that you've done?" Actually, the woman then blames the snake, and that's really another sense of a way of blaming God. You know, when we blame other people for our sin, or when we blame circumstances for our sin, or we blame anything but ourselves, ultimately, we're blaming God. Because who's in charge of circumstances? God. Who was it that put the people in your life that are in your life? God. Who allowed those people to do the things that they're doing to you? God. God's in control of all of that. So when we blame anybody or anything or any circumstances, we're blaming God. It's Proverbs 19:3. "A man's own folly ruins his life, and yet his heart rages against the Lord." That's what we do. So now we get the curse. Starting in verse 14, we read about the curse. And God begins by cursing the serpent, and then next comes the woman and then the man. Verse 16, we'll pick it up with the woman. "To the woman he said, 'I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, he will rule over you.'" And then Adam in verse 17. "To Adam he said, 'Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return.'" So there's two parts to this curse. Actually, we could say there's a third, but for now we're going to focus on two. One is that God curses the man and the woman with regard to their individual roles. Right, the woman with childbearing, the man with earning a living. And in between the curse on the roles is a curse on the marriage relationship itself. That's the part about your desire will be for your husband, he'll rule over you. So let's look at those two. And then the third part is death. You're returned to the dust. And so death comes along too. But as far as the impact on marriage, we'll look at these first two. First, the roles. The extreme feminists of our day just want to erase any distinction between male and female roles. They just want to flatten out all the differences between man and woman and say males and females are essentially the same and the roles are interchangeable. It doesn't really matter. They're just cultural. There's nothing inherent in femininity or masculinity. It's just a cultural thing. Not even the most extreme feminists, however, can get around the fact that pregnancy and giving birth are uniquely female things. The craziness in the news notwithstanding, where the news reporters think that there is a man who's just given birth. I don't know if you've seen that in the news, but there's not a man who's just given birth. There never will be a man who's given birth. That is a woman who just thinks that she's a man and she's mixed up. She had an operation. That didn't mean anything. Every cell in that woman's body is female. You know, our culture thinks that they're so into science and they're so advanced scientifically. They've just thrown science completely out the window. From science, we know. Female body is totally female. It does not change to be from female to male because you do an operation. Every cell in her body, down to the chromosomes. There's no Y chromosomes in her body. Anyway, that's a little bit of a tangent. Normally, you would think that I could just say, childbirth is a female thing without having to defend it. But I think that should be obvious, even to the most limited intellect. So God takes the woman's role of childbearing and increases the difficulty of it. Just makes it harder. And I don't think it would be a stretch to assume that the curse applies to women's roles across the board. All the woman's role, not just childbearing. I think it spills over into to childbirth and child rearing. As well. Child rearing, I think, is hard because of the curse, just like childbirth is. I think all of that is connected. It's why when you leave your wife home all day long with a house full of small children, you come home from work at night and her eyes are the size of quarters and she's just totally frazzled and she's a hair's breadth away from just complete nervous breakdown. That's why that happens. Childbearing, child rearing, homemaking, submitting to you, none of it's a walk in the park. It's all hard. And I think it all comes from the curse. It's all hard because of the curse. And the same is true for man and his roles, male roles. The curse on the role of woman is 10 words in the Hebrew. The curse on the role of man is 45 words. So God demanded accounting from the man first, and then God lets loose on the most extreme curse on the man, because it is the man who is the head of the home who bears the primary responsibility in the marriage. And so man's role of being the provider for the family is cursed. Going to work every day, bearing the responsibility of providing for the family, that constant, relentless responsibility, it's a heavy load. It's a heavy load to bear all through your life. The bills never stop. They never let up. Doesn't matter if you lose your job. Doesn't matter if you get sick. Doesn't matter if you get injured. Doesn't matter if you need a break. Whatever. They just keep coming. The bills just keep coming. And the yoke of having this responsibility of having to provide for this family and be concerned with that is a heavy load because of the curse. And by the way, ladies, I just want to remind you that it's a heavy load that God has placed on the shoulders of your husband if you're married, not you. You don't have to worry about the finances. Let your husband worry about that. It's his responsibility before God, not yours. Your role is just to sit back and enjoy being provided for by a God who loves you and has promised to provide for you through your husband. Your curse is burdensome enough without having to try and shoulder your husband's curse too. God did not design you to be able to handle the stress of both of those. So leave the breadwinning and all the worrying associated with it to him, to your husband. And again, just as the childbearing was emblematic of the whole woman's role, I think the same is true here. It's not just farming that God made difficult. It's the whole of man's role as head of the home that's hard now. Every part of masculinity in marriage is touched by the curse. And again, just another quick aside here. If you're burdened by any aspect of what God is doing right now in your life, what God has you doing in your life, your job, your work at home, raising kids, whatever. If it's parenting or homemaking or whatever, if you are finding some aspect of what you are doing as burdensome, the solution to that is in Matthew 11, 28 to 30. And it's beyond the scope of this, and I'm really, really tempted at this point to get into that, because it's just such an important thing, but it's beyond the scope of this sermon. So if you're unhappy with your job or any part of your calling, I would urge you to read Wednesday's devotional on Matthew 11, 28. If you don't know about the devotionals, they're on the treasuringgod.com, and you can do those daily devotionals. Okay, so for our purposes this morning, all we need to note here is that the man's roles and the woman's roles are now much more difficult. So what's going to be the result of that? Think back to chapter 2. Why do male and female roles exist in the first place? Why did God create them male and female? Why is that repeated so many times in Scripture? Why does He provide Adam with Eve rather than another man or an animal? Well, we found it was because Adam needed what? A suitable helper in order to accomplish his God-given task. And that's where, remember when we looked at the five aspects of the ideal for marriage? That one talks about partnership, remember? The suitable helper points to partnership in the marriage. He was created as a suitable helper to rescue Adam from the peril of having a task that was beyond his ability to accomplish without Eve. And so, in order to be a suitable helper, she had to be female. That's why God created them male and female. That was essential. So, if that part of God's ideal for marriage, this partnership that enables you to fulfill God's calling, if that is accomplished by the man fulfilling his male roles and the woman fulfilling her female roles, and that's what brings about that ideal of partnership, what do you suppose happened when God made the male role harder and the female role harder? What happened is she's hindered from doing her role, he's hindered from doing his role, and that ruins the partnership. You see all that, the logic of all that? Okay. When they put on fig leaves, it ruined the intimacy and the oneness. When they were cursed with respect to their roles, it destroyed the partnership. So now we got three of the five ideals that are messed up. Now let's look at the other part of the curse, the part on the relationship itself. You have the roles, and then in verse 16, second half of verse 16, there's the curse on the marriage relationship itself. Here's what he says. Your desire will be for your husband, and he'll rule over you. First, the woman's side, your desire will be for your husband. That word desire is a term that refers specifically to negative desire. It's a desire to control or dominate or conquer. It's not talking about relational things or sexual desire or anything like that. It's talking about desire to control, dominate, or conquer. The only other time that word is used in the whole Bible is in the same context, just the very next chapter, verse 7. Genesis 4, 7, God said, sin is crouching at your door. It desires you, but you must master it. So that kind of desire, this is a desire, same kind of desire with which sin desires to control and dominate and overcome you. So the first part of the curse on the marriage relationship itself is a tendency for the woman to want to control and dominate her husband. That's the curse. There's something in the heart of the woman that thinks, if this family were just run my way, everything would be a whole lot better. Okay? Some feminine amens there. And so you start seeing the solution to everything as my husband just doing the stuff I think he should do. That's the solution to all these problems. If my husband just do this stuff I think he should do, no matter what the problem is, that's always the way out, is him just doing what I think he should do to fix it. And so women try to gain control over their husbands. And they have a lot of ways of doing that. The way to dominate someone is to use your power to coerce them into doing what you want. And the fact that you live with your husband gives you a huge amount of power. Especially if your husband loves you, it gives you even more power. Because you have the power to make every waking moment of your husband's life miserable. If you're living with him, right? And all women are tempted to use that power to manipulate their husbands. There are many women who hide behind a facade of submission, and they are as rebellious as they come. They think that they're submissive because they never they never just do the opposite of what their husband said to do. And so they say, I'm submitting to him. But the reason they never do the opposite of what their husband said to do is because they manipulate their husband into deciding what they want all the time. Husband knows that if he does anything but what she wants in this particular decision, there's going to be a steep price to pay. She's going to be in a bad mood, or she's going to cry and mope around the house, or be irritable, or whatever. Is that, or she's just badger and badger and badger until he finally says, fine, I don't care about what the wise course is here. I'm just going to do what you want just so I can get you off my back. So women have all these ways that they can pressure their husband into doing what they think is best, and then they can see of themselves as being submissive because they follow along with what he finally caves into. That's the effect of the curse on marriage on the woman's side. Now let's take a look at the effect on the curse from the man's side. Genesis 3:16, the second half of the verse. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. And that word translated rule isn't a very nice word either. That's not talking about male leadership or headship or anything like that. It's a word that refers to the harsh, despotic, heavy-handed, suppressing, dominating, selfish subjugation. There's an old country song that says a woman's place in this old world is under some man's thumb. That really is how it's been for most women throughout history. The woman tries to dominate her husband through the powers that she has, but very often the bottom line is the husband has the brute strength advantage, and so he can just force his way. And so the history of mankind has been a history of horrible treatment of women for the most part. When Jesus came along, he radically overturned the cultural norms with regard to women in his day and showed women equal honor as men, which was really unheard of then. And that ideal was taught then by the Apostle Paul and the other apostles, so that now, wherever Christianity has had a significant influence, women are treated with some degree of respect. In our country, women have the same legal rights as men and are considered persons and not property. And that may not seem like a lot, but compared to the rest of the world, that is not the norm. And where Christianity has not had a big influence, you don't see that. I could tell you stories about how women are treated in Muslim countries that would absolutely turn your stomach. The Quran teaches that men should beat their wives. Not that they can beat their wives, they should beat their wives to teach them. And that's not just Islam. Hinduism gave us bride burning, which still happens to thousands of women every year. Many elderly women in China are crippled to this day because of foot binding. It's an incredibly brutal practice, breaking the young girl's toes and bending them back and binding them up, and just because they think it's more attractive to have smaller feet. Not to mention all the millions of forced abortions in China. The norm throughout church history has been for women to be forced into subservience to men and to be used and then cast aside. And even though our culture has mitigated a lot of that, still the effect of the curse is still present in our culture, even in many Christian homes. There's a shameful abuse of women here in the United States. Many Christian men think that headship means despotism. They think it means I get to have what I want, and when there's a disagreement, I get to have it my way. That's what it means to be head of the home, according to a lot of men. And so you get husbands who order their wives around the house like some kind of domestic slave. Get me something to eat. Get me a drink. Do this, do that, while I sit here and watch TV on the couch. Men like that have absolutely no concept of the difference between submission and subservience. Those are two totally different things. And those kind of men also have no concept of servant leadership either. Jesus taught that at all things being equal, when some kind of serving needs to be done, the one in whose highest authority in the room is the one who should do the serving. So if you're the highest authority, you're the greatest servant. If you've got a group full of guys, all of whose feet are dirty, and the feet need to be washed, then the most logical person to get up and do the foot washing is whoever is the highest authority in the room. That's the way it is in the kingdom. It's the opposite of the way it is in the world. Jesus said in the world, those who are in authority lord it over those around them. So if you have a group of people, the one who goes and gets the coffee and opens the doors and does all that is the lowest authority in the room. So in the kingdom, it's just the opposite. We need to understand that in our marriages. But for the most part, men have not acted like that. They have followed the world's path and have dominated their wives and turned them into servants. So that's the effect of the curse on the marriage relationship. Both the man and the woman try to dominate and control the other one for their own ends. To put it in a word, selfishness. I believe the biggest problem, not only in all marriages, but in all relationships, period, is selfishness. And by selfishness, I mean being self-focused rather than God-focused and other-focused. When Adam and Eve started being concerned about protecting themselves, their focus switched from their spouse to themselves. When you're loving someone, your affection is on them. It's an outward-going attitude. When you're selfish, your attention is on you. And selfishness destroys all five of the marks of God's ideal for marriage: companionship, partnership, oneness, intimacy, and priority. And it destroys all five of those because it destroys that last one, priority. That's the key. The fact that it destroys priority makes it ruin the other four. And if you weren't here in the past weeks, if you weren't here last week, the priority ideal is that verse that says in chapter 2, "For this reason a man will leave his father and mother." Your wife now becomes your highest priority, higher even than the highest human priority of a relationship, which is the parent-child relationship. And so the marriage is the number one priority. That's God's ideal. And when selfishness comes into the picture, that highest priority of the marriage is replaced with self as the highest priority. And when selfishness dominates, you place yourself above your spouse as the main priority. That just destroys the marriage. The covenant loyalty of marriage is the foundation of everything. And when that collapses, you remove that, the whole superstructure collapses. Selfishness ruins companionship because a self-absorbed person doesn't make much of a companion, obviously. Selfishness ruins partnership because a selfish person isn't concerned with helping you. Selfishness ruins oneness and unity because the more you try to dominate and control the other person, the more that person has to protect himself or herself from you. And it ruins intimacy because you can't have a naked and unashamed relationship with a selfish person. That person's number one priority is his own interest, not yours. And so if protecting his own interest and desires means hurting you, then he won't hesitate to hurt you. And so intimacy is gone. And on top of all that, the trust is sapped out of the marriage because you can no longer count on your spouse to be committed to you. He'll be committed to you as long as it seems to serve his interest. And when it doesn't, he'll bail. And so that confidence that nothing can destroy this relationship is gone. And when that confidence is gone, the marriage collapses. You cannot live in a healthy marriage when you're worried about the other person maybe leaving. You have to have that confidence that nothing is going to destroy this marriage no matter what. So if you think your partner might be leaving, then instead of loving him, you just find yourself trying to manipulate him into staying committed to you. And doing that makes you harder to love, which makes him even more likely to leave, and the whole thing gets worse. By far the hardest thing in marriage counseling, all marriage counseling I've ever done, is reversing selfishness. It's just next to impossible. The wife comes in caring about nothing but her husband changing. The husband cares nothing about anything except for his wife changing and how she can be a better wife, and she's thinking how he can be a better husband. And the idea of how she can be a better wife is the farthest thing from her mind. She's just focused on him and vice versa. And you tell them the things they need to do, and it just goes in one ear and out the other. You tell him what he needs to do, and she's sitting there in rapt attention saying, "Amen, amen," and it's all bouncing off his skull. And then you tell her what she needs to do, and her eyes glaze over, and she's not listening, and he's sitting there taking notes. And that selfishness, that focus on how can I get myself served, is just next to impossible to overturn. And when you fall into that, when your whole focus switches to yourself, then it's absolute guaranteed ticket to a miserable life. Miserable life. Does anybody here know any joyful, selfish people? No, there's no such animal. Anyone here ever met a selfish person who has a terrific, fulfilling, delightful marriage? No, it doesn't happen. Which is ironic because the whole goal of selfishness is to make myself happy, and yet it's the surest ticket to misery. Most of the time, the most miserable, unhappy people around are the ones that are the most selfish. Selfish person says, "I need my spouse to love me properly so that I can be happy. I need my spouse to stop doing that stuff, stop hurting me, stop doing the things I don't like, start doing the stuff I do like, or I can't be happy." And those kind of people the same thing in all the relationships. And if you're one of those people, you are probably forever getting upset with your friends and your spouse and everybody around you for failing to love you properly. People like that can't get settled in a marriage. They can't get settled in a relationship of any kind. They can't get settled in a church. They're always jumping from church to church. They're never happy because nobody's ever loving them properly. Every church they go to, the people aren't friendly enough. They're not nice enough. They don't call them enough. They don't pay enough attention to them. And so they're always unhappy because they're unsatisfied with how they're being loved. When your focus is on how well people are loving you, you will be guaranteed to always be miserable. Joy comes when you focus on how well you are loving God and loving others, not when you focus on how they're loving you. It is a wonderful experience to love God, and a especially wonderful experience to love God by loving the people God loves. In John 15:11, Jesus taught us how to be happy. He says, you want the secret to joy? You want the secret to happiness? I'll tell you. Here's the secret. John 15:11, I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. That's how you can have joy. This. You say, what's this? What did he just say? Verse 10, if you obey my commands, you will remain in my love. Well, what's your command? Verse 12, my command is this, love each other as I have loved you. That's the ticket to joy. You don't get happiness in life by being loved by people. You get happiness in life by loving people the way Christ commanded. Your marriage will not improve and your happiness will not increase if your spouse changes and starts doing all the things that you wish your spouse would do. That's not going to make you happy. What Jesus said is going to make you happy is if you love your spouse. You take delight in them. But the world and the flesh tell you the exact opposite of that. They tell you that your energy is best spent trying to get your spouse to love you better. And the tragic thing is most Christian books on marriage just feed right into that. Almost every Christian book on marriage I've ever read teaches some variation of that same thing, that if you, to get your spouse to do what you want, you just give them what they want and then they'll give you what you crave. That's not love. That's selfish, self-focused manipulation technique. If Adam needed Eve back in Genesis 2, before the fall, when everything was perfect and he was in paradise, and even then he needed her help, how much more does he need her now that he's been cursed? His need is a lot more, right? And the same is true of Eve. How much more does she need Adam now? Their needs for each other are far greater now, after the curse, than they were before. And yet, instead of ramping up their help for one another, they both become selfish and try to dominate and control each other. That is what happened to marriage. Marriage is hard because of the effects of the curse. That's why, all those questions I was asking at the beginning of the sermon, the reason marriage is so difficult, the reason there's so many problems with it, is because of the curse. It's cursed by God. And so then the question is this, why did God curse marriage? I mean, why the curse? We talk about living in a sin-cursed world, but that's really not accurate. The accurate way to say it, the reality of Genesis 3 is that the curse came not directly from sin, but from God. It came because of sin, but it was God's curse. It was God who cursed his own creation. Why did he do that? Why curse is great, especially marriage? Why curse marriage? Doesn't God want us to have good marriages? I mean, doesn't God desire that we have ideal companionship and partnership and oneness and intimacy and that we make our spouse our highest priority? Doesn't he want all that? And if he does, why make it hard for us by cursing marriage? Well, the answer is this. The curse was the consequence of sin. Now, think for a minute about why Adam and Eve's marriage in Genesis 2 was so good. Why was it so good in Genesis 2? What was the cause of all that wonderful intimacy and oneness and companionship and partnership and priority? Was it Adam and Eve? Were Adam and Eve the source of all that goodness? Was that inherent within them? No. It all came from God, right? It was grace from God that produced all the wonderful aspects of their marriage in Genesis 2. It was grace that did it. And there's a very important principle that we need to understand about grace. We find this principle in Jonah 2:8. It says this, a very important verse to have memorized. It says this, those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. You see, when you prefer some earthly treasure above God, you forfeit grace that you otherwise could have had. You can't have it both ways. You absolutely cannot have both. You can either have this or that. You can't have both. You can have the grace or you can have this other treasure in this world that you prefer over God, but you cannot have both. Coming to God is like getting married. A woman who wants to get married has to be willing to give up all of her other boyfriends. A person who wants to intimacy with God cannot come by committing adultery with this world. You have to choose one or the other. And so when mankind decided it would rather have sin, it decided to rebel against God, we forfeited the grace of Genesis 2. And so the curse was necessitated by sin. It had to be. It would have been evil for God to continue to dispense the same grace even while man was rebelling in sin. That would have been bad. It would have been wrong for God to do that, and God never does anything wrong. And so he couldn't do that. If your spouse comes to you and asks for money to pay for a hotel for the purpose of adultery, it would be wrong for you to supply that money. And it would be wrong for God to supply us with grace as a reward for rebelling against him. It would teach us the wrong thing. It would be unloving for God to do that because it would just encourage us to do the very thing that's most harmful to us. And so when we rebel, God withdraws his grace. We forfeit it. And that's exactly what happened in the curse. We forfeited grace. And the wonderful news of the gospel is this, that the effects of the curse can be reversed in Christ. Someday, the effects of the curse will be abolished altogether. And even now, it is possible to reverse the effects of the curse in very significant measure. Adam and Eve sinned and forfeited the grace of Genesis 2, and it's possible for us to regain it. You say, how? How's that done? Well, if the curse was the removal of grace, then it's reversed when we pursue the means of grace. And when I say the means of grace, that phrase means of grace means it just means ways of getting the grace back. God has shown us various ways that we can gain access to grace. And if we follow those ways, then we can get that grace that was forfeited in the curse. You say, well, what are those means of grace? What are the means, what are the ways of getting back what was lost in the fall? Well, everything, all that Scripture teaches about marriage is nothing more than descriptions of how to get that grace back. And when you understand that, when you understand that all that is bad about this cursed world is bad because of God's withdrawing His grace, when you understand that, it enables you to worship the God of the curse and to stand in awe of the God of the curse because it shows you that He is the only source of good. If it's true that He is the only good, the only source of good, that means there is no other source, right? It's not a situation where God can remove His blessing, but it's okay because you can run over to this other source, this other shelter, this other refuge, and get some joy there or some other grace there. No, if God withholds it, you don't get it. There is no way to get it. He's the only source. So both blessing and cursing should cause us to stand in awe of Him, and it should show us the goodness of grace, because disaster is the result of God actively withdrawing His grace. That's the only way disaster can possibly happen. And that's a wonderful, incredible truth because it shows how good God's grace is. Do you see how that points to the goodness of grace? If the only way a disaster can happen is for God to remove His grace, what does that say about grace? I mean, does it ever occur to you that the only ultimately bad thing that could ever possibly happen to you would be for God to withdraw His grace and favor from you? Nothing bad can happen to you other than that. That's the only bad thing that can happen. Do you understand that? No matter what else happens to you, if you have God's favor and grace, then you have joy and peace and your highest good. What else do you want? I mean, no matter what circumstances are, if somebody comes, cuts off both my legs, if I have fullness of joy and peace and my highest good, what do I care about my legs? If you have joy and peace and highest good, you don't need anything else. And so the only bad thing that could possibly happen to you would be to lose God's grace. And if the only bad thing that's possible is the loss of God's grace, what does that say about the incredible value of God's grace? And what does that say about what a wonderful God must be the source of such grace? So both joy and pain, both pleasure and pain, should cause us to realize what a wonderful thing, an amazing thing God's grace is. The fact fact that God is the only determiner of whether we receive blessing or cursing should cause us to stand in fear and awe of Him. And it should cause us to be amazed at how priceless is His favor and grace. Ecclesiastes 7:13, consider what God has done. Who can straighten what He has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider God has made the one as well as the other. Let's stand for the benediction. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good work. As it is written, He has scattered abroad His gifts to the poor. His righteousness endures forever. Now He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will also supply and increase your store of seed and will enlarge the harvest of your righteousness. The Lord bless you.